think it is a truth of reality that the things that make life worth living are often impossible to prove or pin down or even put words around in any adequate way.
Hi, I'm Barry. Welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. The ranch is more than just a place you come to get your physical body in shape. Our guests come here to stimulate their minds and feed their spirits. If you want to go to our events calendar on our website, you will see our wide range of presenters each week. We have things that range from psychologists, authors, environmentalists, doctors. We also have art every week and concerts and music to help feed the spirit. I have been so anticipating today's podcast. I get to interview Krista Tibbett today. Krista hosted a podcast for almost 2 decades called On Being. She interviewed amazing people from all over the planet on what it's like to be a human, the questions that no one's asking, questions about religion, faith, and morals. Since then, Krista has written 3 books and is working on her 4th. In 2014, she was awarded the Humanities Medal by President Obama. Gosh, I can't wait to talk to Krista.
Welcome. Hi, Barry. Thank you.
I'm here at Rancho La Puerta. I'm not sure where you're coming from today.
Oh, but... that you're there at Rancho La Puerta fills me with longing.
Okay, so I have to tell you, Chris, when I found out I was going to be interviewing you, I was super excited and nervous at the same time. I think those things go together well, because my master's work is in journalism and you're also a journalist. But I was listening to your vocabulary and I'm like, okay, she must read a lot more than I do. But I love your use of the English language. And I also heard you say, you know, the first question is so important. It sets the tone. It should be a living question. I do know that you asked your guests all the time about their religious and spiritual background growing up. And I know yours from listening to many of your things, that you and I have very similar ones. Basically, no sex.
But a lot of talking about sex.
Yes, but right? But none of it.
Yeah, right.
the question that I'm curious from you, because as I mature and get older, and I have a lot of friends of different faiths, I feel that what a person believes comes next after this physical existence with this body also really steers the way they live their life, or they try to live their life. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts or beliefs in that for you personally.
For me personally, I also think something happens that has happened with me over time, that where I've come is that I'm going to live my life according to my sensibility, my sense of goodness and beauty and balance and all these things I have strived for fitfully, regardless of what comes next. And that it really can't make a difference, because I want to be present to reality as I am participating in it now. And I think the quality of my presence to reality is what I have to be shaping, intending.
It's a practice too, right? A conscious practice.
Yeah. And I would say really that's also a way, really, to me, the best of our spiritual and religious traditions is about helping us do that. And really being present, whatever's going on, including suffering, right? As well as celebration, or crossing all the thresholds we cross in a life.
I would agree with that for sure. I do know from your younger life, you also have said one time that there's so many unasked questions in our youth. Do you still have those unasked questions? And what are some of those unasked questions from your youth?
I'd say there's a way in which I was full of questions, and I lived in a world that was full of answers and that really didn't like questions or kind of wanted to answer them and get on with it. But I think some of the questions that really consumed me when I was young about, you know, what this is all for and... yeah, and who I wanted to be in it. You know, in some ways in my work and then as a human being, I You know, the thing is, those questions, it's just like life is more like science in this way that rather than the way we act like we organize the world, which is we think we have questions and these are things that need solving or answering. But, you know, one thing when I started interviewing scientists at some point early on, kind of surprisingly to me. Mm-hmm. But one thing I love about scientists is that when you make a discovery, the really exciting thing about that is in the next minute, it's what are the new questions it raises that mm-hmm. you now get to follow. And I feel like that is the way life operates for me. So I'm always looking for, so what has this, you know, whatever this has happened or I've learned, then what does this open up for me that I walk into with a certain amount of mystery to it?
I know that you talk about mystery and awe a lot, and I love that. How do you define mystery and awe in your life and in this society? And then the second part of my question is, because I have a lot of young people in their 20s that I know that they don't think that's being a realist.
Yeah, well, we've really done a number on our species, right? Acting like we can count everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the things you can't put a number to, you can't put a price to. I mean, mystery to me is very ordinary. I think mystery is this common human experience. And we just don't, you know, we don't necessarily think about it that way. We think about it as these mountaintop experiences, right? Or kind mm-hmm. of great mysteries. And I think there are those great mysteries and there are moments of great mystery. And I think everybody has those, whatever they think mystery is or is not. Mm-hmm. But to your point, I think it is a truth of reality that the things that make life worth living are often impossible to prove or pin down or even put words around in any adequate way. And that's a strange thing for us to live with as human beings because, you know, it's also like our brains kind of want us to understand. They want to put definition. And I think awe is obviously related to mystery. I'm just going to think about this because it's an interesting thing to put the two of them together because they're not the same thing, right? So last year, in 2023, I interviewed Dacher Keltner, who's written this wonderful, you know, who's really part of the science of awe. And there is this whole new emergent science of awe and just taking it seriously as a human experience. And so, you know, I would say maybe all the things that are part of that, they broke it down into, I don't know, 9, 10, 11 mm-hmm. categories of awe. And you could say that all of those things from, you know, being in the natural world to being in a what they call collective effervescence, like when we're with a group of people having a shared experience, and it might mm-hmm. be a musical concert or a football game, mm-hmm. not for me, but for some people. You know, I think at Rancho La Puerta, those musical evenings, right? Like mm-hmm. there's just something transcendent that happens. And then what the scientists are finding is actually our bodies are syncing up, our hearts are starting to beat at the same rate, we're breathing together. That we don't know, but that is so amazing. There are immunological benefits from mm-hmm. this experience of awe. So I think in some ways, the experience of awe is about sitting before mystery. And it might be really ordinary mystery, you know, like that morning hike and just how it kind of lifts you, right? It lifts mm-hmm. your body and your spirit. Something I love about the science of awe is when they went all around the world with all kinds of people in all kinds of cultures, and they worked really hard not to just be talking to a certain kind of Western person.
Right.
The most often cited category that people had when they asked, you know, an experience of awe in your life was what they later just called moral beauty. But what they were talking about with moral beauty was the awe we get at other human beings, you know, a beautiful life or the way people have come through for us mm-hmm. or we've watched people care for others. You know, be courageous, be kind, be brilliant. And then I think what I'm loving about the science of awe, you know, I have a very modest meditation practice. A lot of us have some kind of, we're learning, like this is such a gift to 21st century humans, this ancient spiritual technology where it's coming to us again when we need it. It has many forms. But something I've been thinking about with awe since I interviewed Dacher is that I think a lot of the spiritual technologies that we're reaching for now, because the world is a scary place and it's a hard place. And also because we lead these frantic lives, right? So mm-hmm. I think a lot of the spiritual technologies, we reach for them to help calm ourselves down, mm-hmm. to get grounded, to keep breathing, you know, to Amen. Get through the day. And what I'm kind of loving about awe as a spiritual practice, which is I think what science is presenting it to us as, is it is actually a different move of saying, I am going to look up and out and be amazed at what there is to be amazed at, and then let that work on me from the inside. So I'm really working with awe a lot these days.
I like the word awe, and I think as I study more and learn more and mature, to me, awe and miracles kind of are similar. I mean, the fact that, you know, I was pre-med and I studied the physical body, and I just remember thinking every morning that I wake up, it's some kind of a miracle.
Yeah.
Everything worked the way it did, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at everything as a miracle or nothing as a miracle. So and to me, that's makes me feel better inside to look at things in that way. Mm-hmm. I also love that you're talking about science, because the other thing I feel that science and spirituality to me are like starting to mesh. When I grew up, there was no, I'll paraphrase this, but I can't remember, you quoted someone and then I'll mess up the quote, but it was something about everything that is true in science, the opposite is also true.
Yeah. So that was Niels Bohr,
one of the creators
of quantum physics. And it's this a mind puzzle that is just so wonderful to walk around the world with.
Yeah.
That in science, there's this notion of a deep truth.
Right, the deep truth, that's what it was.
Right, yeah. And with a deep truth, what that means is that the opposite of this truth is also likely true. Mm-hmm. And that sounds ridiculous until you start pulling out some of your deep truths and putting them to that test.
Right.
And it just reminds us how mysterious life is and how complex and what a calling it is, and also a delight. And also always stretching us to really move as close as possible to reality. And it's not simple. It's never simple.
What is your definition of reality?
Yeah, I am using that word a lot.
I'm just curious because I get told by some people, like my daughter, you're not in touch with reality, Dad. That's
you're
not real.
In touch with reality. It's funny because this came up in the conversation that is on our podcast this week with Janine Benyus, who created the field of biomimicry, which is the realization that the natural world has this genius that's going on all around us, is doing all these things that we think are impossible. In fact, they keep us alive. And, you know, just to boil it down, constantly, the natural world is constantly creating conditions conducive to life. And, you know, that's actually not what capitalism does. It's not necessarily what democracy does, right?
Right.
So she kept using this word, the real world.
Uh-huh.
And she's talking about this real world of the underlying vitality of our planet, of our bodies. You know, so much genius in that, that we, as you said, you just totally take for granted.
Yeah. I absolutely love the word vitality. I want us to start using that word everywhere.
Yeah.
I love that word.
Yeah. It's a different word from health too, you know.
And wellness
it's
too.
And wellness, which I'm really tired of.
I'm tired of wellness too. I think vitality is what we're looking for.
Yeah. And vitality, the thing about vitality is vitality incorporates the things that are going wrong, you know. It's not just insisting like you get to this state that you want to be at. It's complex.
I 100% agree with that. What do you think is the difference between, like, I'm big on words, and like every year I reread the Four Agreements and be impeccable with your word.
I heard about those at Rancho La Puerta for the first time.
I mean, be impeccable with your word. And I think you've said somewhere that words
make worlds. Yeah.
And they make worlds. So, and I think they're important, and the meaning that we give words. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I feel people using the word spirituality and religion and philosophy all mixed up together.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think are some of the distinctions, or are there distinguished person?
Yeah, this is a big one. And then there's this phrase, spiritual but not religious.
Yes, which, I hear that all the time. I've even heard myself saying it about myself before. So,
I mean, we are in this massive evolution of, you know, it's been true for human beings across all time that religious identities were inherited. You just were mm-hmm. born with them. You were right. born with them. You're immersed in them. They could have been good, bad, ugly, indifferent. Mm-hmm. But along with that came some rituals. It came passage, rites of passage, came songs, came mm-hmm. text, came role models and moral formation. And again, these were always imperfect because they were being administered by human beings. But even if you didn't like what you grew up with, you had something to work with. You know, you had something to fight with. And now in a very sudden, you know, very short span of time, we have that fall away. And I think part of the spiritual but not religious is an understandable and justified reaction against religiosity, religion in modernity. You know, again, mm-hmm. this is very much kind of community to community, tradition to tradition, but lots of it kind of betraying what it was about. You know, I find a lot of young people who say they're spiritual but not religious, they actually look at the tradition and say, like, if you acted like what I think a church should act like, I would be interested in you, right? But what right. they see is something that has totally betrayed the heart and spirit of it. I don't think you can actually, I think there's a symbiosis between, I think of religions as the containers for spiritual experience and all the things that we have created to pass that experience on, to deepen it communally, right? Mm-hmm. Like the rituals and the songs and the texts and the teachings. So I think whatever religion and spirituality are going to become, and I think we're in an in-between time, so we know what it's not anymore, and we can't yet see how it's going to work. But I don't think we lose the traditions, but they're going to have to be differently rediscovered, and mm-hmm. and they're going to have to recover their heart. And I think they're going to be less set apart from the world in these nice buildings, mm-hmm. right? Because they didn't actually start out in nice buildings. They started out around dinner tables and with people in the woods. And
right.
So that's what I think, we're in a really transitional time. But, you know, what is clear, because when I started my show 20 years ago, and in the beginning it was called Speaking of Faith.
Yes, I remember.
On public radio. Yeah.
And I love the word faith, too.
You do? But that's a tricky word for a lot of people.
But I mean, like, I think people also mix up hope and faith, and I think that they're very different.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's a word we need, but it needs a lot of resuscitating, because it's very damaged for some people. But I think, you know, in the late 20th century, early 21st century, there was kind of this idea that, well, religion is waning, and that somehow meant that people would become less spiritual, right? That this irrational part of us, or it would just assume this really private, appropriately small place. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, you do not, in my mind, cease being a spiritual person in the absence of a belief in God. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is part of who we are. And to another, you mentioned religion, spirituality, philosophy. I would also add the language I'm using a lot these days is moral imagination. And like,
I saw that.
And this is also the place in the human enterprise. These are the places in our lives where we got some kind of raw materials for moral imagination. Again, it might have been what we rejected, but there was something to work with. And you know, what I'm clear on about also in this century is all of the great things that we are called to stand before in our world require a lot of moral imagination. And so where are we going to get that? And I do think that the traditions and the spiritual technologies have a role to play.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with, my dad has a priest and two nuns in his family. And I know your grandfather was a preacher. So this, I mean, I haven't been in church forever and ever. And this last Christmas, I went to midnight mass just because, and I could remember everything. And for some reason, I felt warm inside when I did that. And it was the ritual about, you know, it's
we
super
need ritual. I think our bodies, absolutely. Ritual is, I think it's essential.
I'm Christina Carlson. I live in New York City, and the ranch is my most favorite place. I've been coming to the ranch since I was in high school. I discovered it when I was 15 years old, and I have been coming every year ever since. So for a record, maybe 41 years, I have inside my medicine cabinet a collage of photos from the ranch. Because if I can wake up every morning and I can see Mount Kuchuma and I can see all the pictures I have of the friends that I love, that I spend every week here, I can get through my job in corporate America. I can get through all of the stresses of daily life in New York City because I know I'm going to be coming back here in 51 weeks and that gets me through.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I'm just so excited to talk to you. I keep going all over the place. But moral imagination, it almost sounds like there's moral and then we can like, you know, bend it a bit. Because, you know, traditionally I grew up like, this is moral, this is not moral. There's always this or that.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean to you, moral imagination? Is just rethinking this human condition and where we've evolved to and where we're going?
Yeah. Well, so I think, So I think what you described is what I also got, which is morality and moralizing, right?
Yes, yes.
And that was about what's right or wrong or good or bad.
Right.
One way to talk about it is just think about this phrase I used a minute ago, creating conditions conducive to life, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not about having a formula, but it is about kind of coming at what we have to deal with in a way that has positive values attached, but also that is creative and that sees beyond what we're working with now. So if we say that the underlying principle of the natural world is creating conditions conducive to life, you know, what if we applied that to, I don't know, our racial life together or our ecological predicament crisis? Because the thing is, the other thing about living now is that none of our institutions are quite working anymore because the stuff that came out of the 20th century just doesn't, it just doesn't work. And it's actually not very humane. So, you know, like schools, everybody who has kids has to send their kids to school, but we just know it's just very imperfect.
Yes.
And if you think about creating conditions conducive to life, we don't believe anymore, many of us, and people who are looking at the science even can't believe this, that it's enough to teach kids math and English or make them memorize things, right? Or sit in hard chairs all day and have, right? And have, so what would it mean if like to be moral imagination would be we start our deliberations also with this sensibility of human flourishing. And then how do we make that happen? Because we actually know things about that, but that's not usually the question we're putting in front of ourselves. I mean, I was very honored a couple weeks ago to spend some time in Sing Sing prison with people of just incredible dignity. You know, that's not a question we ask of how do we design a prison to create conditions conducive to life. But this punitive society that we live in and that we accept and that then really throws people away in this very expensive institution that we're all paying for, you know, what if that were the question? So I think moral imagination is a way of thinking and asking rather than fixed ways of answering.
You did a TED Talk recently with the three things. And I think that's your third thing, right? I think it was spend time with
wholeness.
Things that are life-giving or life-enhancing. Your first point, which is the reason that I'm not pursuing my career in journalism, is that there's always something good happening. And I remember when I was in journalism school, it was like, if it bleeds, it leads. And I still feel like our society is so obsessed with what's going wrong instead of what's going right. Is that what you were saying with that?
Yeah. And we're captive to our brains, which were designed to keep us safe. And they are always on the lookout for danger. And then we live in this pretty dangerous time. And so we actually have to put a lot of intentionality and discipline into kind of overriding that, into, say, looking for the good. It sounds simple. And actually, I think it's something that really gets it gets instinctive if you do it, but it's a funny thing because it's not actually primally instinctive.
Yeah, we're born with a negative bias. Right? Yeah. I think that's how we're born. And then you spend your whole, like me, I'm spending my whole life trying to rewire those synapses in my brain.
No, that's what happens at the ranch, really, is people come and you get, you know, the thing is, if you get settled in your body, you get rested, you get nourished, you get enough time looking up and out at the mountain or the flowers and breathing that fresh air, then your whole system is calm and you're actually much better. It's much easier to say, oh, look at what is so beautiful about this world. Yeah.
The third point you made is like, you know, I know that you're a parent and I'm a parent. I can remember when my daughter was probably between 3 and 5, it was every 2 seconds, how come, why, how come?
Yeah.
And I can remember even back then what I told her is, all I know for sure is I don't know for sure.
That's right. And that's such a gift we can give our kids, telling them the truth about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, so your thing is live the question and it's okay. Yeah. It's okay not to have answers. Yeah. And I mean, really, there aren't a lot of answers.
No.
But to know that there's a question, I think, is needed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of beautiful questions that would lead us in really generative, fascinating directions if we followed them. Because we're so fixated on answers and solutions, we don't let questions lead us. I mean, when I talk about living the questions as a virtue, I'm not saying that we are in this state of, you know, just blissful unknowing, that we give up.
No, I
think questions, if we follow them, they take us to very concrete places. They challenge us. They stretch us. And, you know, we have all kinds of decisions to make and actions in our daily lives. But if we have a bigger frame of time and we understand ourselves to be, you know, if we're tending to it, the fullness of our lives in every moment, as well as what is right in front of our noses, we need some different muscles for that. And living the questions is kind of helps us cultivate a different muscle.
One of the big questions that I think is present right now for all of us is AI. Mm-hmm. And I think AI, we're always going to have to find a way to have it teach us something. Hmm. How do you feel about?
I've been dissatisfied in this year and a half or whatever it's been since suddenly it was in every single news story,
I felt like the
conversation. You know, there are basically two ways to talk about it, and one way is, isn't this cool? Isn't this neat? Look at what it can do. And then the other one is, this is terrible. It's going to kill us all. And the question I'm following now, I understand that there are dangers, and I understand that there's a lot of triviality to it as well. And I think we underplay that. It's just another, in some ways, it's another, you know, toy. But what I want to know, or what I want to really let it invite me to and us to, is, first of all, I think the language artificial intelligence is ridiculous. But like, what is intelligence? And and there's a lot of, if what I see a lot of happening is a lot of people saying, well, AI can do this, but it will never do this, right? Only we can do this, right? Or I was actually at a really high level event just last week in New York, and somebody said, you know, we are conscious, AI will never be conscious. Well, I'm sure she's really smart, but I don't know how she knows that, because we don't know what makes us conscious, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a very interesting exercise. But I think the question of what is human, what is fundamentally human, is interesting and worth us pursuing. And AI is kind of a corrective to this kind of post-enlightenment, you know, glorification of our brains. Mm-hmm. And I really use the word brain as opposed to a mind, because I think the mind is actually the brain and the body and, you know, all of us, the interplay between those things. So I've been really fascinated in this year and done a lot of focusing on what is the intelligence that lives in our bodies. Possibly I'm doing the same thing she was doing when I say this, but I, you know, again, I don't think we know where consciousness comes from, but I don't see, AI has been a student of us on the internet. And it is a student of our words and our ideas and all those things that the Enlightenment glorified and said, you know, I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. It does not have visibility to the intelligence in our bodies, to things that we navigate and know, like, love, right, that actually define the quality of our lives. And just the way we've been learning that things that, you know, we used to think about emotion or spiritual experience or trauma or grief, you know, or joy as, you know, as emotions in some kind of box. And like what we now know is all of those things are very physical, mm-hmm. and they are this really wild interaction that's going on all the time, like from our mm-hmm. brain through our vagus nerve and our, you know, learning how important our gut is in all of this. And so it's that wild interplay that is just to a small amount cognitive, merely cognitive, that is the human experience. And I think it kind of liberates us from treating ourselves like these chin-up creatures, like the only thing serious or interesting about us is our computational power, you know, our thinking power.
Reasoning, I think.
Reasoning, yeah, being rational. I mean, how boring. And it's gotten us into such trouble trying to make everything rational. So that, I feel, could be a great adventure.
Yeah, I hope it will be. I have faith that it will be.
Okay, that's
adventure.
Good.
I know, I want to be respectful of your time, but you mentioned a word that, love. Mm-hmm. And love is one of those words. This is me maybe oversimplifying for myself, but love is one of those things I can't define. I don't have anything to prove that it's there, but I am 100% sure it exists. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, that's one of the things that makes me believe in something greater than me, greater than all of us. What do you think about the word love? Do you think love is overused? Like love, kindness, those words?
Well, I think the Beatles were right. I think all you need is love. I think that's true. Okay, mm-hmm. fine. I do think the word is overused because the word is too small. It's like the word God. I mean, what are
too small
everything
for
we're trying to get into that word? And in other languages, there are many words for love. You know, in Greek, there's philia, there's agape, which is more practical love, mm-hmm. the love that is about what you do and not how you feel. And there's eros, of course, which is more kind of, I think, when we talk about love a lot, that's maybe the one that romantic, erotic. Mm-hmm. But love, and when I talk about the intelligence of love, yes, I think one thing I'm grateful for from my Southern Baptist grandfather, from my upbringing with him, as harsh as his rules were and as small as his heaven was, is that he gave me this sense that there is love behind this universe. And there's a lot of mystery to that, about what that means and how it functions. And then why there's so much that is devastating about this universe. But I also, I feel that and I experience it again and again. I'll tell you, the other day I was listening to the BBC, and it was actually a report from Israel. And this woman was talking about her elderly father who was a hostage. Her mother and father were taken hostage, and her father is still a hostage. She was speaking in a very matter-of-fact way, like full of emotion, but very matter-of-fact about why she assumed he was no longer alive. Because she said, you know, we talk about water and we talk about medical care, but she said that an older person could live this long without love, I just don't think so. And she said that, and it's true. We don't talk that way. We don't let it in, but we can't live without love.
Yeah.
I once interviewed an astrophysicist who works with looking for habitable planets. And she said, you know, she thinks of love like dark matter in physics, which is this force that we can't explain, we can't measure, we can't quite see it. Like, we can see it's there because of all the things it moves around.
Mm-hmm.
It permeates everything somehow. So it's, you know, it's reality with a capital R.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we can't hold it in our hands and quantify it. And, you know, when I talk about the intelligence of love, and I do this a lot in the context of our life together, which is the opposite of loving, like by any definition, right? How we are politically and culturally. But if you think about in our lives, the way love works, the intelligence that we have is, you know, we learn so many things, right? Like the things we do in public right now on social media, like you say the first thing that comes into your mind, right? Mm-hmm. When you are actually loving someone and living with them, you learn not to say what just came into your mind because you want them to hear it, right? You actually, we have all this intelligence about what not to say or what not to say now, what to hold for later. We know that love, you know, it's not to me a romantic, fluffy thing. Like we know, even in our most intimate lives, that our love for others is often about, like, it's about not how we feel at the moment, and yet what we do anyway, right? These small actions by mm-hmm. which we show love. And love, as it functions, is very rarely about feeling like we're perfectly understood or we perfectly understand, and yet we know how, with all the complexity of another human being, to stay in relationship. That's a, you know, that's a very sophisticated, complicated, dynamic thing.
Right.
So I wish we would take the reality of how we make love happen in life and apply the, you know, the intricacy of that and like the fierceness of that and the not unromantic nature of that to the rest of our life, like our life, our political life. That is deep, deep, deep intelligence.
One of my favorite quotes ever with Maya Angelou, she's like, people forget what you say, what you do, but they'll never forget the way you make them feel. And I think that is love, that peace.
I love that. I'd never heard that. I think about wisdom in a similar way. I actually wrote a book about with the wisdom in the title and then realized I'd never defined the word wisdom. And so people started asking me. And I realized, like, I think a life of wisdom, I think the difference between, like, we know what a life of accomplishment is, or we know what a life of knowledge is. Like, those are things you can point at. Like, he, you know, she knows this, or he did that.
Right.
But I think that the measure of a wise life is always going to be the imprint that life made on other people around it. Like, so any of us can think of the wisest person we know, what we start thinking about is how they rippled out, right, and touched mm-hmm. other people.
I think that's beautiful. Are you still working on a new book?
Yes, I am. It's taking me a long time.
Yeah. Is there a working title or no?
I had a book that was supposed to be done in May 2020, and May 2020 defeated me.
Yeah, well, it defeated a lot of people. momentarily. It was
and
a big
now,
question.
Yeah, and now I have to, I'm working on what it needs to be, but there was a time when it was called The Possibility of Wholeness, because wholeness is my desired answer to wellness, you know? I think really what we want is to be whole.
Right. And that encompasses everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's great.
But I'm also working on another book side by side about my years in Cold War divided Berlin. Mm-hmm. And that's really fun to write about. So yeah, hopefully I'm going to get more time in the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll come to the ranch for part of it.
Well, I hope you'll come to the ranch. I would love to.
Desperate to get back.
You just tell me when you want to come and we'll make it happen. I don't know about what love is, but I can tell already that I love you. So
thank you. I love you too. Well, see, I've loved you for a long time, but I was an anonymous person in those rooms with you.
That's true. I mean, I'm like, I feel like I'm researching to do this interview is like, I feel like I know you and I, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I so admire you and I so appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
It was really fun.
It's super fun, yes. And I also believe, I think I heard you say this one time, that humor is spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So, well, thank you so much. And I'm going to keep emailing you to come to the ranch. We would love to have you back.
Okay. Send my blessings and love to the ranch. Okay.
I will. Yes. All right. Deborah's 102 now, so.
Oh, I can't believe it. Talk about the wise life that imprints other lives, right?
Exactly. 100%. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Barry, what a joy this has been.
It's been a joy to spend time with you. Thank you so much. So I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Wow. Today's conversation with Krista was amazing for me. As a journalist myself, I love words and what meaning we assign to words. And we had a great conversation along those lines. The other thing that I really loved is she talks about living the question. A couple years ago, I read something that said,
sometimes it's enough to know just that there's a question. There's not always answers. This world is changing rapidly, and sometimes it's a hard world to live in. Krista pointed out that there are lots of questions and lots of ways to ask those questions, but it's important that we ask those questions. It's important that we live those questions. Another word that she used that I love is reimagine. We can reimagine the future, reimagine solutions, even reimagine the questions. Once you live the questions, there might be some solutions. So I hope you had some good takeaways today, where it even makes you more curious about some of the questions in your life. Until next time, this is Barry. I'm wishing you health, daily joy, and lots of curiosity.